Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
From Nice Guy Productions world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is the fun size edition of Postmortem AMA, where you can ask me anything. And asking your questions on your behalf is none other than producer Joe Russo. Producer Joe, how are you?
I am doing well, Mick. I saw an R-rated comedy in the theater last night with a huge crowd, and it was good. I'm in a great mood.
When's the last time you had that experience?
I honestly, literally, probably couldn't tell you.
Hangover, maybe?
No, definitely since then.
Oh, good.
You know, actually, I did. That's not entirely true. I can tell you when it was. It was a month ago. I actually caught a sneak preview of another upcoming R-rated comedy called Strays. It's the
Will Ferrell
talking dog movie.
Yeah,
I quite enjoyed it. It was very fun. It's about a dog who is trying to return home to his bad owner to bite him in the dick.
Well, there's a premise that had to have been an easy pitch.
Yeah, you would think. I mean, no, it's really funny though, because that I grew up on movies like Homeward Bound, which had like talking animals, so it's kind of like perfectly zeitgeisty for my age to have now an adult already. But no, I saw the new Jennifer Lawrence comedy No Hard Feelings last night, and it was a really solid no high concepts, no explosions, no sci-fi, no superheroes, just good old-fashioned relationships and conversations about sex and love and growing up.
That sounds like something we really need right now. And if you saw it in a crowded theater, that's a very good sign.
Absolutely. How are you?
I'm good. I'm looking forward to hearing the questions that make this show what it is. Well, from our fans who are so terrific and so supportive and so generous with their time and their thoughts and questions.
Well, we've got a lot of good ones today. Though we're going to start with probably a little contentious one.
Uh-oh.
Tony Nacho writes, as a writer myself, the podcast episode detailing the Writers Guild of America strike was of particular interest. Though not a member, I stand with the WGA about receiving fair residuals from streaming services. But why is the creative world suddenly concerned with artificial intelligence? It seems disingenuous to stand in front of the rumbling AI tank now when it's already bulldozed through many occupations within the last decade. When blue-collar workers first started losing jobs to automated technology, a lot of middle-class workers offered their advice to learn another trade as a solution. Why can't this same advice be given to writers and other creatives as AI gains more of a foothold on our world?
Well, it certainly can be. AI, artificial intelligence, and automated work are two entirely different subjects. But, you know, we speak from within the job that we do and how it affects us. The difference about AI and screenwriting is what you feed into AI is what has gone before. and what comes out of AI is a conglomeration of what has gone before without the human quality of individual imagination. So maybe there's a combination of such, but that's the primary issue is if you think the world of franchise movies now is bad, if the scripts are composed by AI, they are just going to be worse. I mean, the sameness that we have from so many movies today is based on corporate choice. The sameness that you have if it comes belching out of an AI system isn't just corporate choice, but it's also all it can do is remanufacture what has been fed into it and spit it out in its own language. And that is not the language of creative thought and ingenuity.
And then I don't know if you caught this week, Mick, but Warner Brothers is planning to use artificial intelligence to help them greenlight movies too. Is it not going to be forward thinking, it's only going to be taking into account what worked in the past and telling the studio to greenlight based off of that regurgitation.
Well, and again, we're talking about the movie business because we work within that movie business. And the word disingenuous is not appropriate in this regard because, we all have concerns about other people who are affected by this. But AI can be useful in a lot of ways, but it's not a creative force.
Yeah, it can't think, it can't feel, it can't understand. So when we are synthesizing the ideas around us, our experiences around us, and putting them into a story, that's the magic sauce that can help push film and TV into new directions.
I mean, when you're talking about the 10th sequel to a movie, maybe AI would do just as good a job as anybody else, but I'm hoping that the ingenuity and talent and creativity of the writer will bring something new and fresh to even the 10th sequel of a franchise.
Exactly. And we're not working in a factory. We're not, you know, kicking out widgets. There's a little bit more nuance than that. And I think that's where the rub comes from. And that's why people are so upset, because people want to have that human touch to their film and television. And that's why there's such an uproar.
But it's not just we in the film industry. I mean, fine artists and commercial artists are having their work replaced by AI. And it's amazing what AI can do. And a lot of it is really good. And a lot of it is like shockingly good. But it affects the individuals in ways that our questioner brought up and are valid points. But I can only speak from within the industry in which I work and have a sense of unity and sensitivity to how it affects other people too. And illustrators are among those who are most harshly affected by this.
There was a really great round table discussion on the Movie Crypt a couple weeks ago that Joe Lynch and Adam Green did, and they had David Slade on. Really worth going and listening to if you want to hear a really in-depth conversation about how AI is reshaping the industry, not just potentially from a writer's perspective, but from directors and other craftspeople within the VFX community and such as well. One follow-up question, Mick. Have you tried AI yet? Haven't fiddled with it yet?
No, I haven't.
No. Well, I will say it still leaves a lot to be desired.
But you know, they're going to work that out. And you know, it's brand new in the way it's being used now. And it's only going to get better and more power to it, but it's never going to be human beings.
I will say the only real benefit I've found in it thus far is as a more sophisticated search engine. Instead of, me asking it to write a scene, if I ask it for a specific, thing about, some sort of health issue, right? Let's say I'm writing something about a health issue. Instead of sending me a bunch of, like Google, I go to Google, it sends me like 100 web pages on the subject. It'll actually give me like a really concise page to read.
I mean, it's not worth dismissing or ignoring, because it is an important tool in so many ways.
So yeah.
We'll just have to see what happens, but it's a very valid issue for our guilds to be concerned about.
Yeah. Our engineer, Chris, says he uses ChatGPT to help him make his grocery list. So
there you go. That's much, nice much, and creative.
Much more functional use of it. All right. Ben writes, I have a lot of respect and admiration for you, Mick, and the way you carry yourself. I'm also a fan of your art.
Well,
the way you talk to people and about people is really uplifting. I understand you have many years of social skills and practice and experience. Have you ever thought about running for a political office or being a community leader in some ways? I feel your wisdom and humility is infectious. Listening to you reminds me there is good things in the world, and I try to do better.
Well, that's very, very kind and generous, and I really appreciate those kind words. I mean, I've kind of spent my life being a bridge over troubled waters between fighting parents, between fighting band members and things like that. But the last thing I want to do is be in government, you know, especially these days. I have no interest in that. I have no interest in fighting and compromising and not being able to fulfill the things I think are socially and important in any way. The idea of running for an office would be insane. Competing, I don't compete with other people that way. I don't want my life turned into 24 hours of turmoil. I have no sense of anything positive about being a politician.
Well, there you have it. There will be no Mick Garris for president anytime soon.
That's for sure.
All right. Mr. Zeno writes, Joe and Mick, I don't know whether you've touched on this before or at what depth, but there are an awful lot of people named Joe Russo on IMDb.
Yes, there are.
Could you break down which is which, and does our Joe know any of the other Joe Russos?
Yeah, well, this is one I'm going to hand over to you, Joe.
Yeah, well, this has been a shadow that I've had to deal with pretty much my entire career. So the Italian equivalent of Dan Smith is Joe Russo, I feel like. It is probably like the most common name you can find out there. So yeah, there's a bunch of us I think it goes stretches all the way up to like the teens of Joe Russo's on IMDb. And what's even crazier too is probably the one who casts the biggest shadow, the Russo brothers, Avengers Endgame Joe Russo. He's listed as Joe Russo number 3 on IMDb.
Wow.
So he's not even number 1. I'm Joe Russo 7 on IMDb.
Oh, that's not bad.
It's not bad, but the good news is when you search on IMDb for us, we are the top 2 Joe Russos.
Excellent. So yeah. The other part of Dave's question was, do you know any of them?
Well, I don't actually. Well, that's not true. There is one Joe Russo who worked at a management company, and I have met him before, and we had a lot of fun, you know, kind of going back and forth on that. But Avengers Joe Russo and I have only traded emails. We've never actually met in person, though I have met at his company before. I think he's just afraid that we're going to, you know, meet and have to do a Highlander and there can only be one. I've invited him to join me on the picket line, Mick, but weirdly he hasn't answered the call. So that offer still stands. The closest I came to meeting him was when I went into his office and when I checked in at reception. I always get very confused looks when I tell them my name is Joe Russo, and that amuses me very much.
Identity theft. Okay, we're alerting the authorities.
Yes, exactly. So there you have it. I haven't met a lot of the other ones. There are a lot of other ones, but at least the first two that come up are hopefully the most important ones to you.
Exactly. All right, then.
Adam Langham writes, I recently watched the Keanu Reeves hosted documentary Side by Side, which features many filmmakers talking about the differences between shooting on film and digital. There are several well-known directors who have a strong preference for one over the other. If money was not an issue and you had complete freedom to choose, which is your preferred medium and why?
I have to tell you, I go digital. Most filmmakers of my vintage are committed to 35 or 70 millimeter film. And I love that in its first screening. By the time a print has screened for a week, it's scratched, it's dirty, there's crap all over. When you project film, even the best, smoothest projectors, there's judder, the image shudders just a little bit. Film breaks. If properly maintained and properly shot and properly projected, digital film, film in quotes, P-H-I-L-M. So it's rock solid. The colors never change, no matter how many copies you make. It's digitally perfect with film. If you go down a generation, you see the grain increase. You can get prints that vary in color if they're not properly handled. And just the idea of doing visual effects with a digital image in the first place makes it much more compatible with the finished product. So I believe that digital filmmaking has gotten to the point where it at least equals and in many, many ways exceeds what you can do with film. I know Quentin Tarantino and Christopher Nolan and a lot of other people would argue that point. But for me personally, I find it a more satisfying medium with which to work and where there are fewer issues of quality between me and the projectionist.
But that's kind of in release though. But what about on set? Which would you like if you had the choice? Because obviously 35 millimeter, if you shot in 35 millimeter, it can still be converted to digital for release.
It can, but you still have issues with if there's dirt on the gate.
Right. Check the gate.
Anything like that. Check the gate. It still judders a tiny bit. And with digital, and I know you said if cost was no issue, with digital, you can keep running for 2 hours as long if you want. And you're limited to 8 or 10 minutes on a reel of 35 millimeter film. Yeah. So you have to change mags every 8 or 10 minutes. And digital, a lot of people never cut, which is something that drives editors crazy and myself when you have to go through dailies when nobody cuts. That's no fun. But for me, I still lean toward digital in every regard, even shooting and not just projection.
Yeah, no, I think there are definitely a lot of advantages to digital, even if it is not the traditional way.
It's not traditional and you have to impose grain into it or else it looks like high definition television.
That's right.
But they have gotten to the point where it at least meets the quality of 70 millimeter film at its best, but without the possibility of destructive elements.
Totally agree. Well, let's switch from directing to writing. Jim asks, when you write a script, you always start by reading everything you've already written before you begin the day's work. But do you do the same thing when you're writing a novel?
For the first half, I do. Once I'm halfway in, and having reread everything every day as I lead my way in, I don't feel the need to go back to the very beginning, but just a couple of chapters. Yeah. Because I've got the rhythm going, the pace is going. A script is 100 pages. A book is 200 to 300 pages for me. I've not written a long novel at this point. So I know it really well by the time I'm halfway through and just go back a couple of chapters.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to make any kind of forward momentum, I imagine reading the entire the entirety of the novel is going to eat away at more of the day than you're going to spend writing.
Well, it's going to take me more than a day to read it. So
yeah, exactly. So that makes sense. When you get towards the end of the script, like when you get to the 85s, 90s, the 95s, do you still start from the beginning?
By then, probably not. Because by then, I'm not just writing 5 or 10 pages a day. If I've got 15 pages left, I'm going to try and do it all in that last day and keep the momentum going.
Right. Yeah, no, I tend to, when I get deeper into the scripts, I'll still start from the beginning every couple days or so, but, you know, it takes time to read just like it takes time to write. So,
And you also work with a partner, so you are engaging each other in that as well.
Yeah, but when we're drafting, we're working separately. So you know, it's a little, we're not like, if we were writing over each other's shoulders, like creating new pages with the other person watching, I don't think we'd ever get anything done. we'd be arguing over every word, you know. So
I can imagine.
Yep. All right. Rick writes, Mr. Garrison, producer Joe, I just recently started listening to your show and absolutely love your podcast. While I hope it isn't too late in life, I'm 46 years old and have always wanted to be part of the entertainment industry in some form. I love to write and have been working on 2 full-length screenplays. How are you able to get it into the right hands as a means to sell a script?
Well, that is a question that comes up on this show often. And
yes, but if Rick is a new listener, he probably hasn't heard our age-old advice.
Yes. Well, the most important person and gateway for a new writer is an agent or a manager. It's very difficult to get through their lockbox to get to them. You have to have something that stands out from the pile of scripts that they take home every weekend, usually 30 scripts, and something that engages them on the first page, certainly by the first 10 pages. But getting through to them is difficult. Screenplay competitions are very important, and film festivals often have screenplay competitions. The Austin Film Festival is very screenwriter-centric. They have competitions, they have seminars, they have places where you interact with agents who are looking to represent new talent and acquire new talent. There are a lot of people who are just going to try and get your money and take advantage of you because as with new actors or new writers or new directors, they can just offer you a seminar or something that's useless. But there, just, you know, Joe has some festivals and competitions in particular that he can recommend. So producer Joe, have at it.
Yeah, no, the Austin Film Festival is one we always recommend. I think that's probably the best, most screenwriter friendly of the festivals, and the one that agents and managers will pay the most attention to. The Final Draft competition is a good one. Coverfly, Roadmap Writers, tracking-board.com. And then obviously the Nichols Fellowship is kind of the most prestigious because it's run by the Academy of Motion Pictures and Arts and Sciences. So, you know, there are a handful out there that can, you know, if you can place in those contests, you can definitely spark the attention of agents and managers. But, you know, I think we'll also say, we've said it before, the best way to do it is to have someone make a real human, genuine referral for you. You know, if you can find someone who you make a good enough relationship with, and they read your screenplay and they like it enough and they have access to an agent or manager, that is always going to be the best way to put a piece of material in front of a potential representative.
And then that material has to stand alone. It has to be something you don't make excuses for. Well, it's my first screenplay, anything like that. It has to be something that engages the reader, makes them want to keep turning the pages all the way to page 100 and be excited about it. And hopefully there's a voice that stands on its own. But to engage with well-written characters in a compelling story, in a way that feels fresh and in a way that's well-written and not misspelled and grammar a mess. All that stuff matters. And for it to be formatted properly, all those things, that's your responsibility. Then it's getting it into the hands of people whose responsibility it is to find a home for it.
Yeah, I'll never forget one of my early general meetings. One of the producers of the recent Mortal Kombat said to me, I almost never finish scripts and I almost never finish them in one sitting. And that's why we're meeting. He read the whole thing in one sitting. So like that, you know, it can't just be good. It has to be great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's gotta be eye catching.
Yep.
Brain catching. Anyway.
All right. Rob and Tom write, "Hello, Mick and Joe, big fans here in the UK.
Hello,
Rob and Tom. So Rob's son, Tom, is just setting out on his own horror movie journey. Tom has shared his favorites, age rating permitting, and they recently sat down to watch Psycho. So Tom's question, his son enjoyed the movie, but its classic status was a little lost on him. Tom writes, I tried in vain to explain why it's so important, but sadly, I failed. Mick, please help me out here. I think it's time we get an answer straight from the top."
I don't know about the top, but you know, there are a number of reasons Psycho is a classic, but also a number of reasons a young person might not appreciate its many values. First of all, it was made in 1960. It's in black and white. What people don't realize is that most horror movies at that time were monster movies. They were intended for a young audience, especially a teenage audience that was discovered in the 1950s, where they had I Was a Teenage Werewolf, I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, I Was, you know, all of these, How to Make a Monster. And you had the Japanese kaiju movies and all those things. This was the first true horror movie that the monster lived next door, that it's a human being and was motivated by psychological elements that had never been touched on before. In this case, they talk about it as transvestism and the like, but it was based very, very loosely on the life of Ed Gein, who would kill women and wear their flesh as costumes so he could feel as he was a woman. It was Alfred Hitchcock, who was known for really breezy, wonderful suspense films that were great, but also had a very Hollywood sense of style and entertainment value. He chose to shoot this in black and white with his TV show crew, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents crew. So it was being made as if it were an episode of his TV series, but it was, and Universal didn't want to support it. And Hitchcock put his own money into it and it became the best decision he ever made. He made a fortune off of Psycho because he did invest in it because the studio didn't want to. It was Paramount, not Universal.
Right.
Universal.
Right. And he took it over to Universal. Now. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So Universal owns all the Psycho movies now, including the one that I did, Psycho 4. But it stretched the boundaries of what a horror movie could be. It wasn't just a fun monster fest. You know, it wasn't a Universal monster movie. It wasn't an AIP monster movie. It wasn't Edgar Allan Poe. But it was something now. It took place now. The monster was a serial killer, as he would be described today, who lived among us, who seemed like a sweet young man. And nobody had ever done that before. And it took Alfred Hitchcock and his confidence. He had read the book written by Robert Bloch, and then Joe Stefano wrote the screenplay, and they made something that was a sensation, lines around the block. It was like The Exorcist when it came out. It was like Jaws when it came out. It changed the course of horror movie history and influenced everything after it, especially John Carpenter's Halloween in 1978. Ooh. Went to the same roots that Hitchcock had gone to in Psycho. And so it just remains influential, even though it may seem slow and it's in black and white and it's in a different era that's, you know, 60 years ago. It was so influential and still remains influential in a very innocent seeming central character turning out to be the monster, the wolf in sheep's clothing.
I think also too, at the time, there hadn't really been any movies that mainstream audiences had seen where who they thought was the protagonist, spoiler, is killed off at the end of the first act. And we kind of get all new characters to invest in. That was a pretty radical revolutionary idea too, right?
Right, absolutely. I mean, Janet Leigh is the lead name on the posters and everything. And 20 minutes into the movie, she is slaughtered quite brutally in a shower scene that, again, before that time, even though you never see the knife piercing flesh, and they had built a dummy and everything to actually stab on screen and bleed and all, it was this masterful collection of shots. It was still more brutal than anything that a studio had ever released before.
Yeah, no, it was it truly was a revolutionary picture and casts a very big shadow over the horror genre.
It still does, yeah.
Part of which Mick is inclusive of. So
right. I'm the sole surviving director of a Psycho movie.
That's not something to. There's only four of you, you know. So, yeah. All right, Mick. Well, that wraps it up for this week's Ask Mick Anything.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you to all the listeners out there for your great questions. And again, we'd really appreciate it if you're enjoying the show, if you would post your thoughts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your casts.
Yeah, give us those 5 stars. and if you want to send questions for future episodes, you can send them to our email, askmickanything@gmail.com, or you can find Mick or I on the social medias. Mick's at Mick Garris PM on Twitter and Instagram, and I am at Joe Russo Tweets and at Joe Russo Graham on Twitter and Instagram, respectively.
And Mick Garris and the Postmortem Mortem Podcast are on Facebook as well.
That's right. So that old dinosaur of a platform. You can follow us at all the places, and maybe we'll ask your question next time.
That's great. Thank you, Joe. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Mick.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.